I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, and a beautiful Tuesday it is, the 20th of May. A New York Times Adam Liptick piece caught our eye recently, The Polarized Court. Citing the latest campaign finance decision last month, Adam writes, the five appointed by Republican presidents voted for the Republican National Committee, which was a plaintiff. The four appointed by Democrats dissented. That 5-4 split along partisan lines was by contemporary standards unremarkable, but by historical standards, it was extraordinary. For the first time, the Supreme Court is closely divided along party lines. That's what we talk about this hour. Our guest is co-author of the report, Split Definitive, How Party Polarization Turned the Supreme Court into a Partisan Court. Neil Devins is professor of law and government at William & Mary. He also has served as assistant general counsel for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and project director for the Vanderbilt Institute for Public Policy Studies. We'll be looking at the appointments and how politics plays a huge role. Interesting information on the social networks which these individuals are a part of. So really, conservative Republican justices interface, he writes, with elites who support conservative outcomes. Democratic justices interface with elites who support liberal outcomes. Party polarization also defines the appointment and confirmation process. And things are not likely to change anytime soon. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and you can reach us on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Professor Neil Devins, thank you very much for being with us.
I am pleased to be with you.
Nice to have you here. For the first time, the Supreme Court closely divided along party lines, so it has not always been so?
Never really before Elena Kagan joined the court in 2006. There was a conservative liberal divide that existed before that time, but among the liberals were John Paul Stevens and David Souter, both Republican appointees.
So it used to be that there would be Republican presidents who may nominate somebody who was a liberal Republican or maybe even a conservative Democrat, and Democratic presidents who may nominate a liberal or a moderate Republican and a more conservative Democrat. They used to mix it up much more.
Yes, absolutely. And this is a reflection, of course, of the polarization among political elites that has been going on in this country, really growing with the start of the Reagan administration. So it used to be that there were Southern Democrats that were important to the Democratic Party, and there were so-called Northern or Rockefeller Republicans that were important to the Republican Party, and presidents would point across their parties, which included liberals for the Republicans and conservatives for the Democrats, but today that is no longer the case. The elites are polarized, that the conservatives are exclusively or nearly exclusively Republicans, and progressives tend to be Democrats. Mm-hmm. So the appointment process today reflects changes in the political parties and changes among the political class.
And it isn't, as you point out in your report, it's not just politics. It's also, it extends to social networks, which these individuals are a part of, the clerks they hire. Pretty much across the board, they're hiring people who share their political philosophy and going out for dinner with those who share their political philosophy.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And it used to be in, say, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that the elites were dominated by moderate liberals. Richard Nixon complained about the Washington cocktail circuit that was overwhelmingly liberal. But today, starting really after Ronald Reagan became president, there's been a rise of a conservative legal network, and in particular, the Federalist Society has been a breeding ground for conservative lawyers who become part of this social network as law students and continue on. People like John Roberts and Samuel Alito worked for the Justice Department as young conservative lawyers who were part of the Federalist Society Conservative Legal Network. And then when they join the court, it's no surprise that they continue to socialize with the very people they socialized with before and seek reaffirmation from the very people that are their friends, which is true across the board. It's just today that there is on the right, in particular, a conservative network that reinforces the position of conservative justices.
Professor Devins, did someone, and if so, who or whoever may be involved in this, set out deliberately to create a conservative legal movement?
So I think Attorney General Meese, who is Ronald Reagan's second-term Attorney General, was instrumental in all this. There was a recognition among Attorney General Meese that there were very few reliably conservative judges that Reagan could elevate to the Supreme Court. And there was a sense that there needed to be essentially a breeding ground created, a farm team, if you will, that would allow for Republican presidents in the future to have conservative judges available to them. And obviously these conservative judges would have originally been conservative lawyers clerking for Republican judges or working in Republican-dominated law firms, what you had mentioned earlier in the broadcast.
And the influences of earlier presidents, say Kennedy, other presidents, were to appoint people for whom they were doing a political favor, or why?
Well, it ranged. Sometimes it was a political favor. Earl Warren's appointment by Eisenhower was tied to the work Warren did for Eisenhower to become president. Sometimes, and this was true of Harry Truman, he appointed close friends from his Senate days, and these individuals tended to be far more conservative than Truman was himself. Abe Fortas, who was appointed by Johnson, was Johnson's personal lawyer. So some of it is people you know. Harriet Myers was nominated by, obviously, George W. Bush. Some of it is people you know. Some of it is political favors. Some of it is a sense of party obligations. There was a desire to appoint Southerners or appoint Catholics. That helped explain William Brennan's appointment and Lewis Powell's appointment. Just a spectrum of factors. But ideology was a concern, but not the dominant concern. But over the past 20 or 30 years, ideology has become the dominant concern.
When you write about Kennedy appointing Byron White, who often joined forces with more conservative justices, when you talk about several Republican appointees, Harry Blackmun, John Paul Stevens, and David Souter leaning strongly to the left, did those decisions made by those particular justices appall the presidents who appointed them, or did they figure, well, this is just, they have minds of their own, and this is okay?
Well, I think the presidents who appointed them probably did not have a very strong personal jurisprudential view on certain issues, perhaps, maybe on certain race issues. Justice Kennedy, who appointed Byron White, would have had a point of view, and maybe on privacy issues like abortion, Ronald Reagan would have had a point of view. But to tell the truth, for the most part, presidents do not have strong points of view on constitutional questions. So the issue is largely determined outside of ideology up until recently, where within the Justice Department and among the elite class, there's a strong emphasis on ideology. So in some sense, it all makes sense this way, right? So if presidents don't care that much about ideology, they are more likely to pay attention to personal friendships or political favors and be less concerned with how the justices vote. So in an earlier era, presidents just simply put on the court justices who served a purpose that was non-ideological, and the fact that they may have voted conservative or liberal wouldn't have been that bothersome because ideology was less pronounced, less prominent in their agenda. Today, presidents are more likely to care about ideology because the political elites that dominate the parties care more about ideology, and the individuals who are going to be most involved in the nomination process – are going to be very much focused on ideological concerns as opposed to concerns of patronage, for example.
So what would be Republican ideological concerns and Democratic ideological concerns, and how would you determine if a potential justice, how would you determine his or her ideology?
So in some sense, it's not so hard because Republicans are overwhelmingly conservative and Democrats are overwhelmingly liberal simply by picking someone who is well-credentialed and well-established and well-liked within the community of lawyers that a president might select for a judge, almost by definition, because of the narrower ideological band within each party, is going to accomplish the job. So you're not going to find a John Paul Stevens or a Byron White, Byron White being a Democrat, Stevens being a Republican, in their parties today with the positions they had at the time they had them. There are not going to be John Paul Stevens among the eligible Republicans to choose from, and there are not going to be Byron Whites from the eligible Democrats to choose from. So in some sense, just by virtue of the polarization of the elite class, a lot of the work has been done. On the Republican side, in addition to that, the Federalist Society has served, as I mentioned before, as sort of a farm team, an involvement in the Federalist Society and working oneself up through the conservative legal network will also serve as a strong signal to presidents that someone is an acceptable, reliable conservative, if you will. On the Democratic side, there's a counterpart group called the American Constitution Society that arguably serves a similar purpose, but it is less significant than the Federalist Society is on the Republican side.
Take into account what you write about the demise of Southern Democrats and Northern Republicans and the related rise of elite polarization. Direct result of demise of Southern Democrats and Northern Republicans?
I apologize. Could you repeat that?
The polarization of the parties, the ideological bent of the parties, is it directly the result of the demise of Southern Democrats and Northern Republicans?
Well, it's obviously a contributing factor. It's really the demise of conservatives within the ranks of the Democratic Party, and that's epitomized by the exodus of the Southern Democrats. And the demise of progressives from the Republican Party, as seen as the exodus of the Northern Republicans. But arguably, the political strategy of Reagan to try to get the Southern Democrats to vote for him contributed to this. But the two are very interrelated.
And if this is the way that it's all working these days, it's hard to imagine what would change it, isn't it?
It's not likely to change. Things are likely to, if you think this is a problem, things are likely to get worse, not better. On the court today, there is one centrist of sorts, the largely but not completely conservative Anthony Kennedy, who votes with the liberals about a third of the time in significant cases. Once Kennedy steps down from the court, if he is replaced by a Republican, that Republican is going to be much more like Chief Justice Roberts, that group of cases that Kennedy joins with the liberals will no longer exist. On the other hand, if Kennedy is replaced by a Democrat, that individual is going to vote most likely like Justice Elena Kagan or Sonia Sotomayor. And the group of cases, where Kennedy might, as a Democrat, flip and vote with the Republicans won't exist either.
How old is Kennedy?
I think he's around 80. I don't know precisely. Mm.
So he's not really, that's somewhat young for a Supreme Court justice, or is it?
Well, he's not likely to retire for President Obama to replace him, but obviously... the president who comes after President Obama might well be the one to replace Justice Kennedy.
So what are the ramifications of all of this?
Well, the ramifications are that the idea of seeing the court as being above partisanship is clearly no longer the case, which is not to say that the court will not decide cases unanimously. They often do, and is not to say that the court will not seek legal answers to legal questions with integrity. But the idea of the court being removed from politics as having the sort of advantage of time and life tenure will give way to an understanding of the court as being a Democratic or Republican court.
Mm-hmm.
And this may result in a range of complications, because if you have, for example, a Republican president coming after President Obama and solidifying the conservative majority and making the court even more conservative, if the president after that and the president after that turn out to be Democrats, the possibility of there being a political divide between the Supreme Court and the rest of the government is that much more likely. And that is arguably a problem, that the court might not work in sync with the larger political values of Washington, D.C., and it's more likely there will be a division between the court and the rest of the government. It obviously breeds cynicism in the law and our legal institutions, and that's obviously not healthy either. So there are a range of reasons that this is problematic.
Mm-hmm. So I trust you would be a believer in presidential elections making a difference.
I don't think there's any alternative in our system.
We're going to welcome... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Right. But, you know, I think one has to ask a slightly different question, perhaps, which is to say, if this is bothersome to us, maybe we wish our political parties could find a way to cut across ideological lines more than they do today, and that we, need to have different views of this, of the soundness of political parties that are so divided. At the same time, with campaign finance,
mm-hmm.
and other things, and as I said, the polarization of the elite and news media that essentially feeds into that, with the rise of the internet and conservative-friendly sites and liberal-friendly sites. It's going to be very difficult to overcome what we're now seeing. It's likely, as you had mentioned before, to get worse before it gets any better.
So the question to the audience is whether or not this is bothersome to you. Our guest this hour is Professor Neil Devins. He's a professor of law and government and director at the Institute of Bill of Rights Law at William & Mary Law School. We're talking about the partisan court and the very interesting history here, where it is historically it has not been a very partisan Supreme Court, and his report and reports from others show that we are living in an era where justices are less prone to drift, and with no post-1990 Republican justice moving to the center-left, there has been a hardening on the right, and there has been, except in some kinds of cases, and we'll ask him what cases result in unanimous decisions, but all of these 5-4 decisions, which really are ideologically based, so that we know which way the democratically appointed by president judges are going to vote, and simultaneously with the Republicans. Does all of this bother you? Do you think we should have a court that is decided on reasons other than political reasons, that we shouldn't be examining what the ideology is of those who may be appointed to the court? And does it bother you? Do you know that we'll have certain kinds of decisions because of politics that will be settled certainly one way, depending on who has the majority? Would you agree that this will be the case for some time to come? Or are there some decisions? Some would say that these campaign finance decisions have been extremely problematic for the country and for our elections. And is there anything so big that has been decided on an ideological basis that it would make Americans say, enough of this? You know, we need to do this in a different way. Here's our phone number. We would love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at KDunn Show. Our lines are open for you right now, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Professor Neil Devins is our guest, professor of law, government, director of the Institute of Bill of Rights Law at William & Mary. And we're looking at today's Supreme Court, the first to be divided along partisan lines, and the ideological divide between Democratic and Republican appointees ever widening. What does that mean to you? Let's go to phone calls, starting with Tony, who's calling from Minnesota. Hi, Tony.
Hello. One of my biggest concerns over the last several years is the divide in the Supreme Court, along with the divide in our political system. I believe the vast majority of us who are out in the middle are forced to choose, and I believe it's going to bring a breakdown in credibility in the court system and the political system, which probably most people are already viewing. I don't know how it's going to resolve, but it is getting to a critical point. And I guess I'll take comments off the air.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Tony. Professor Devins.
Yes, I think that there will be increasing skepticism of seeing the judges as being above politics, and increasing sense that you will see the justices on the court as being identified with one or the other political party. And that will undoubtedly come at a cost to the court's legitimacy and the understanding among the American people that the court is a neutral umpire, to borrow a phrase coined by Justice Roberts.
How much legitimacy did the court lose in the 2000 presidential election, Professor?
Well, as it turns out, not much. But what happened is that Democrats tended to become more skeptical of the court, and Republicans tended to become more supportive of the court. So the court essentially issued a decision that was a wash in terms of attitudes towards the court as an institution, but it solidified the sense of partisanship among particularly Democrats who saw the Bush v. Gore decision as a partisan decision made by the Republicans on the court.
And when you talk about unanimous decisions, that many decisions are unanimous, what's the nature of those cases?
So the issues that tend to divide the party and divide the nation, abortion, affirmative action, same-sex marriage, voting rights, campaign finance, these are the sharply divided decisions on the court where partisanship is particularly important. The court hears many other cases involving issues of statutory interpretation or issues of jurisdiction and issues that are not the types of issues that people would talk about over dinner or learn about by watching the news. They're more, if you will, a legal issue without a political side to it, notwithstanding their import. Those are the issues that tend to bring the justices together, where they're seen, if you will, as questions of law with no political ramifications. The questions that separate the justices tend to be the legal issues that have political ramifications, where the two parties come at those questions in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to June in Shawano. Hi, June.
Hello?
Yes, hi, June.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I hear you too well, Kathleen.
Go ahead. We hear you, June.
Okay. My question is this. I have heard in the past, with example of the Warren Court, that it was too activist. Now, that was generally a Republican view. Now I hear from the liberal side that the court is too activist. Is this a bad thing? And what is the cause of this? if you know.
So as to whether something is a good or a bad thing, you know, in some sense, in terms of the complaints from the liberals about the Warren Court and the the conservatives about the Warren Court and the liberals about today's court, there's a little bit of a whose ox is gored aspect of it, obviously. The court certainly needs to, on occasion, invalidate acts of government. Not everything the government does is constitutional, and for the court to be legitimate and to stand tall as an independent branch of government, it has to sometimes invalidate acts of government. So there's no problem with the court performing that role. That is clearly part of its role in government. The question is, when it performs that role in a way that people deem as the Republicans on the court striking down Democratic legislation or the Democrats on the court striking down Republican legislation, that becomes problematic because it seems that it's about power and politics and not about law. So that's the hard question for the nation and the hard question for the court. I should mention the fact that there's partisanship on the court also does not mean that every vote Chief Justice Roberts issues in a controversial case is going to be a conservative vote,
right,
and every vote that Justice Breyer issues in a controversial case is going to be a liberal vote. On occasion, the justices break ranks, so to speak, from what one would associate as their ideological position. Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts in particular, upheld the health care statute. You know, Justice Breyer has voted against, if you will, affirmative action in the recent Michigan case decided this term. So that happens. So when we talk about partisanship on the court, also, I just want to clarify that partisanship means a tendency for Republican justice to vote for conservative outcomes and a tendency for Democratic justices to vote for Democratic outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, June, for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about today's Supreme Court, the first court to be divided along partisan lines, which, of course, has a lot of consequences. And we're talking about what those are and how it came to be that we have this partisan divide, not on everything, as our guest has just suggested, but on many issues. You can expect certain Republican justices, Republican-appointed justices, to vote a certain way, Democratic presidents appointing justices who will vote another way. Why is that? How do we get here? What do we think of it? 1-800-486-8655 is our number. Email is talk@wpr.org. John in Charlotte, North Carolina is next. Hi, John.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I think this topic. Good. This topic is fascinating, I think, because it really shows the separation between government and now the court. And the one question I want to bring up, and just I want to ask your guest, I notice, if you ever notice this, when they announce a court decision and it's a decision based on a 5-4 split, they always say the partisan side, it was a partisan decision by the Republicans to go with this decision. And they never mentioned it was a partisan decision by the minority to go the other way. It seems partisan has become the Republican word. And even though I believe you've been pretty balanced in your discussion, but many topics on I listen quite a bit of public radio, and they constantly use partisan for Republican, and a decision by the left where there's a majority, they just say it's a decision. Do you see any validity in that?
Well, the reality is that there are 5 Republicans on the court today. So the partisan divide, when it occurs, is going to be a divide in which the Republican majority stands together, just by definition. But the interesting question will come if a Democrat becomes president in the next election and we have a Democratic court. And that Democratic court is also likely to decide in a partisan way, if you will, on some of these divisive issues. And we will see at that time whether this station and the media in general describes those cases as partisan. We're going to have to wait until there's a Democratic president to test the proposition, though.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's a valid and interesting question, John. 800-486-8655. Can you imagine, and maybe one of those decisions has already been rendered, a decision that was made that could be made by either a Republican majority or a Democratic majority that would be so distasteful to people on the other side of the partisan divide that there would be some kind of uproar about this, that there would be, I know that there are little pockets of dissent, and some of them are fairly large with the campaign finance decisions. There are people who are very worried that it's going to change politics forever in this country, and not for the better if you're not on the side of what the justices ruled. Can you imagine a decision that would just sort of upset everything and make people say, who are appointing judges, we got to find people who are independently minded?
Well, the justices today, are reflections of the views of people within their party. And the issue of being independently minded is a harder nut to crack today because there are fewer conservatives and, if you will, independents within the Democratic Party and fewer liberals and independents, so to speak, or moderates within the Republican Party. So to really get at the problem, you need to have a broader change in the political culture so that the parties are not homogeneous, reflecting narrower ideological bands that are further apart from each other. And that's what makes the problem with the court one that's likely to continue, because to overcome it, you have to really overcome what is happening within the political class and what is happening within the political parties. And the court is just simply a manifestation of that large phenomenon.
Well, I know you're also a professor of government. What is it that would cause the parties to reformulate themselves? It seems as though the American public are calling for much more moderation and for people to sit down at the same table and go out to dinner and work out legislation together, even though they have different ideas about how things should be done. Do you think that will be translated to a transformation of this ideological rigidity?
Not in the short run. If the Republicans are able to win, even if they lose the presidency, but are able to win the Congress, the parties will not need to reinvent themselves. The Republicans will simply claim the Congress and the Democrats the White House, and there won't be pressure within the party to fundamentally retool the vision of the party. So the Democratic Party began to win everything, or the Republican Party began to win everything, the other party might need to reinvent itself, and that might lead to broader changes down the road, but those aren't happening anytime soon, as revealed in the current political cycle. When you look at what's happening, for example, in some of the Republican primaries now, there's not a movement towards the center at all.
Mm-hmm. What about the process of confirming a nominee? Doesn't that allow for ideology to be examined and rigid ideology to be the reason for non-consideration of a nominee?
I think that there's increasing party line votes in the Senate on nominees, particularly to the Supreme Court, or nominees to some of the more prominent federal appeals courts. What could happen is if you had a Republican Senate and a Democratic president, or a Democratic Senate and a Republican president, is you could see pressure from the Senate that the president appoints someone within his party who is more moderate, but at the same time, a more moderate Democrat may look like Elena Kagan, and a more moderate Republican may not look that different than John Roberts. Within their parties, they are not at the extreme by any stretch.
And yet some would argue that you need people who have strongly held opinions if you're going to come up with decisions that make a difference, that are important decisions for a population at a certain point in history.
Yes, and it is possible for the justices, and this, you know, is reflected arguably in the Chief Justice's vote on the health care statute or in the vote mm-hmm. of Justice Breyer most recently in the affirmative action case. You know, not every case will be a case where the justices split strictly along partisan lines, and there will be crossovers, and obviously Justice Kennedy, as noted, crosses over around a third of the time to vote with the Democratic justices, but arguably there are issues in the health care case is arguably one of these cases where the Chief Justice thought that the cost to the court of striking down that statute were arguably too significant to do so, and was willing, you know, to either put partisanship aside, or some would say put his view of the Constitution aside, to vote in favor of the law.
More phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour has done a major report on today's Supreme Court, the first court to be divided along partisan lines. The ideological divide between Democratic and Republican appointees is ever widening. And we're talking about why that has happened, what other courts have been different, why they have been different, and what it means for the future. Our guest is a professor of law, government, and director of the Institute of Bill of Rights Law at William & Mary. And he is Professor Neil Devins. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Professor Neil Devins, and let's go to Milwaukee, to Mike in Franklin next. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Professor, here's one thing that's been bothering me for the last couple years. It's like this thing about corporations being people. It's like there's been an extension, okay, that the way I look at it here, I'm a person, I'm represented by the Constitution. The CEO of a corporation, he's represented by the Constitution, okay? But all of a sudden, it's like he's got some extra power because his corporation is also represented by the Constitution. And it just seems to me like it doesn't hold water that should be extended to corporations.
Well, this is, you know, a legal question that has divided conservatives and liberals, and most Americans actually oppose the decision of the Supreme Court on campaign finance and Citizens United. But on occasion, Congress itself has weighed in originally on the question of who counts as a person under the law, and there's an issue before the Supreme Court this term on a contraception mandate to the Affordable Care Act. And one of the questions in that case is whether a federal statute called the Dictionary Act, which actually allows corporations, or arguably allows corporations, to be seen as persons for purposes of the law. And people may disagree with that, and people may disagree with the rights afforded corporations through the Supreme Court's First Amendment interpretation. I'm going to stand to the side of having an opinion on that legal question, and I will say that issue will be reconsidered undoubtedly if a Democrat becomes president after President Obama and has a chance to replace one of the Republican justices. So if you do not like the Supreme Court's approach to that question today, there's a pretty good chance that you will see the court reverse course on that question in the next 4 or 6 years.
Thank you very much for your call, Mike. The New York Times article that caught our attention and led to today's discussion had these pieces of information, which I find really amazing. Justice Scalia told New York Magazine in September of this year, We just get the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Times. He canceled his subscription to the Washington Post, he said, because it was slanted and often nasty and shrilly liberal. He said he did not read the New York Times either. I get most of my news, this is a quote, probably driving back and forth to work on the radio, he said. Talk guys, usually. Justice Lena Kagan, appearing before the Federalist Society in 2005 when she was dean of the Harvard Law School, said, and this is the conservative organization you told us about, she admired its work, but she added, "You are not my people. Do we need any more? Do we need any more information to show where everybody is?"
No, it's a striking thing, and it's generally true of the American people today, particularly those
yes.
who pay attention to the
yes.
news, that liberals tend to look to liberal-leaning outlets. The Huffington Post is more popular for liberals than is the Drudge Report, which is more popular for conservatives.
Right. Let's go to John in Milwaukee next. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Why can't we? We got to slide away from these two Blood and Crips parties, gangs up there that divide the money, the corporate money between them, and have the same program, and have it like six or eight parties like the French do in a parliament where there's a lot of debate and media where there's a lot of debate between the ideas that people have. And it's really ridiculous that the dictatorship of the media and the two parties.
Do we need more? Would that change at all, Professor Devens? I can't imagine that's going to happen, but maybe
it would if we had arguably three parties and needed coalitions to win the presidency or to win the Congress, then it might change the balance. But it's unlikely that third party would be the moderate party. It would be interesting to see if such a party could exist and draw enough voters to form coalitions with the Democrats or the Republicans. I think it's pretty unlikely.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's go next to Jane in Milwaukee. Hi, Jane.
Hi, I will try to be succinct. I know time is running out. What I want to say, first of all, I joined the conversation halfway through, so I hope it's relevant. What I want to say is, as a citizen of this country, I am very distressed at what I'm seeing with the Supreme Court and have been for some time. It feels as if the ideas that were set in motion by the people who founded our country, the ideas about having three separate branches of government no longer exist. I know that there's variation and all of that, but it feels like it doesn't exist to the extent it used to. That coupled with the Republicans attempting, and I say it not in a non-biased way, it's trying to pull back voting rights, and also with the wealthy being able to, our laws now allowing the wealthy to have so much influence on elections. As well as things like ALEC, organizations like that, that we are in danger of losing our democracy. I think we're beginning to reach a critical mass of people who are realizing that and are opening their eyes. And I think the Supreme Court is one more important example of that.
Professor Devens.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court, even if it's a partisan court, still performs its role in our separation of powers. So, for example, we now have a quote-unquote Republican or leaning Republican court that stands to review the actions of a Democratic president. So that does not necessarily mean that a partisan court does not perform its independent checking function. It just means that what it does will be understood in partisan terms. So when the Supreme Court rules against Obama, and if all the Republicans are lined up, you mentioned Bush v. Gore earlier, it looks like the court is playing a political job even if it is performing its role in the separation of powers.
Thank you very much, Jane, for the call. Let's talk about the importance of law clerks here. The numbers here are striking as well. The Times article says, in the last nine terms, the court's current Republican appointees hired clerks who had served first for appeals court judges appointed by Republicans 83% of the time. Justice Thomas hired one clerk from a Democratic judge's chambers, Justice Scalia none. The numbers on the other side almost as striking. Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan hired from Democratic chambers more than two-thirds of the time. Justice Stephen Breyer is the exception. His hiring has long been about evenly divided. Well, let's talk about him for a moment. Why would he do that, and why wouldn't others follow suit? He's doing something that nobody else is doing. He obviously thinks it must be important.
Well, different justices have different philosophies. Justice Scalia, earlier in his tenure, used to always hire a quote-unquote liberal clerk who would always be there as a foil and someone who would argue against the positions of the justice so that he would better appreciate what those positions are. You know, for Justice Breyer, he may be doing this because he has less strong ideological convictions is comfortable with clerks of a broad ideological spectrum, and it might enhance his reputation as being an independent. There's something in it for Justice Breyer, who is, if you will, the moderate among the Democrats, the least liberal among the Democrats, where he can show you and everybody else in the nation that he's willing to hire from both Republican and Democratic judges, which gives him extra, so to speak, credibility for an audience he wants to appeal to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason you see the Republican justices hiring from Republican judges and the Democratic justices hiring from Democratic judges is a little bit more nuanced than ideology. It may simply be that the Republican justices are part of the social network that the Republican judges are part of, and the Democratic justices are part of the social network that the Democratic judges are part of, and they may feel beyond ideology that they're just getting better information about these clerks because their close friends have loyalty to them more than to their clerks, who are going to tell them which clerks to hire. So it's a little bit of a complex story, but at the same time, it's very striking, and it does call attention to the fact that the Republican justices see themselves in, if you will, cahoots, or the Democratic justices see themselves in cahoots with the lower court judges of their party.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, Professor Devens, you're a professor of law and a professor of government. You have studied the history of this and follow it very closely. Is all of this upsetting to you? Is it upsetting to our democracy?
So I don't think this is healthy for reasons we discussed earlier. It is not personally upsetting to me. It seems to me to be a manifestation of the larger issue of polarization in the country, which an unfortunate fact of life. But sometimes it also slows government down, which isn't always the worst thing in the world. But it's not good. It's not good for the court. It's not good for the country, even if it's not particularly personally upsetting to me.
And what about to Americans? Have you seen polls that show that they are tied into this issue and following it and find it upsetting, or they don't care?
Well, most Americans don't pay that much attention to the court or its decisions, but there's a general sense among Americans today that's more skeptical and pessimistic about the court and views the court in more partisan terms than it has in the past. This has not been good for the court. But it's what the court, so to speak, deserves because the court, in fact, is more partisan than it has been in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the hour. It was really interesting. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Professor Neil Devens, professor of law, professor of government, director of the Institute of Bill of Rights Law at William and Mary. He was Assistant General Counsel for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and he's the author of Shaping Constitutional Values, the Supreme Court, Elected Government, and the Abortion Dispute. We thank him for being with us. The New York Times article that drew our attention to all of this will be on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up in a moment, and we'll return with more conversation.